It's a Friday edition of the My Ag Life Daily News Report. Welcome, everyone. I'm your host, Lori Boyer. Taylor Charlstrom will be in with a report today previewing another speaker for the upcoming Crop Consultant Conference. I'll have a check-in of regional and national agricultural news, beginning with regional ag news right after this.
The Crop Consultant Conference returns on September 28th and 29th in Visalia, California. Co-hosted by Progressive Crop Consultant Magazine and the Western Region Certified Crop Advisors Association, this two-day conference features two concurrent CE tracks for both PCAs and CCAs. Earn the DPR and CCA credits you need. Network on our trade show floor and join us in giving away scholarships and honorariums presented by Western Region CCA, including the CCA of the Year Award. Visit progressivecrop.com/conference.
A portion of San Diego County has been placed under quarantine for the Mexican fruit fly following the detection of six flies and one larva in and around the unincorporated area of Valley Center. The U.S. Department of Agriculture, the San Diego County Agricultural Commissioner, and the California Department of Food and Agriculture are working together on this project. The quarantine area in San Diego measures 77 square miles, bordered on the north by Wilderness Gardens Preserve, on the south by Lake Wolford Park, and on the west by Musa Canyon, and on the east by Hellhole Canyon Preserve. As part of the eradication effort, approximately 250,000 sterile males will be released per square mile per week in an area 43 miles around the infestation. Sterile male flies will mate with fertile wild female flies but produce no offspring. This reduces the Mexican fruit fly population as wild flies reach the end of their natural lifespan with no offspring to replace them, ultimately resulting in the eradication of the pest. In addition, properties within 200 meters of detections are being treated with an organic formulation of spinosad, which originates from naturally occurring bacteria, in order to remove any live fruit flies and reduce the density of the population. Fruit will also be removed within 100 meters of the properties with larval detections and or female fly detections. The quarantine will affect any growers, wholesalers, and retailers of host fruit in the area, as well as nurseries with Mexican fruit fly hosts. Local residents and home gardeners affected by the quarantine should consume homegrown produce on site, to include canning, freezing, or juicing, and should not move host items from their property. These actions protect against the spread of the infestation in nearby regions, which may affect California's food supply and backyard gardens and landscapes. The Mexican fruit fly can lay its eggs in and infest more than 50 types of fruits and vegetables, severely impacting California agricultural exports and backyard gardens. USDA's National Agricultural Statistics Service Pacific Regional Office wants recipients of the California Irrigation Survey to know there is still time to respond. In July, NAS mailed the survey to around 20,000 California farmers and ranchers. A joint project between NAS, the California Department of Food and Agriculture, and the California Department of Water Resources, the California Irrigation Survey measures irrigation methods used within the state. The data gathered will be compared with earlier surveys to study how irrigation methods are changing and make projections of future changes, according to Richard Snyder, Emeritus Biometeorology Specialist with the University of California, Davis. All information reported by individuals will be kept confidential as required by federal law. Additionally, USDA's National Agricultural Statistics Service will continue collecting responses to the Conservation Practice Adoption Motivation Survey over the coming weeks. A representative for NAS may call producers to set up an interview to assist in the completion of the questionnaire. In late May, NAS mailed the survey to over 3,500 California farmers and ranchers. A joint project between NAS and USDA's Natural Resources Conservation Service, this new survey is aimed at better understanding conservation practices adoption and the role of technical and financial assistance. The data will be used to guide the implementation of NRCS programs in the future. There are two versions of the survey this year, one requesting information on crop conservation practices and one for confined livestock conservation practices. Data from both versions of the survey will be available later this fall on NASA's website. And again, all information reported by individuals will be kept confidential as required by federal law. Tattooed Chef Incorporated, a leader in plant-based foods, announced an expanded distribution agreement with Walmart Incorporated that will increase the availability of Tattooed Chef branded products at Walmart stores across the United States. The company also announced the simultaneous signing and closing of an asset purchase agreement with Desert Premium Group and the signing of a new lease agreement that will strengthen its vertically integrated operating model and add approximately 80,000 square feet of manufacturing capacity. Under the agreement with Walmart, Tattooed Chef will increase the brand's frozen shelf presence from 5 to 13 SKUs and expand the availability of these 13 SKUs from an average of 300 Walmart stores to an average of 2,000 Walmart stores. Initial availability of Tattooed Chef's products at these new Walmart locations will be expected no later than October of 2022. Tattooed Chef also announced the signing of a definitive agreement and simultaneous closing under which the company acquired certain assets from the Desert Premium Group for approximately $10 million and a signing of a lease agreement for an 80,000 square foot manufacturing facility that will be located in Albuquerque, New Mexico, at which the assets acquired currently operate. The Desert Premium Group assets include packaging and production equipment, and the lease facility greatly expands the company's manufacturing footprint with significant cold storage and ambient storage. Tattooed Chef is a leading plant-based food company offering a broad portfolio of innovative and sustainably sourced plant-based foods. They are headquartered in Paramount, California.
Sponsored by the California Walnut Board and Commission, supporting the industry with on-farm innovation through production research, advocacy for government programs, and driving consumer demand. Doing more together.
Continuing our preview of the upcoming Crop Consultant Conference in Visalia, California on September 28th and 29th, conference speaker George Zhuang, a UCCE viticulture farm advisor, joins the show to discuss his topic this year, grapevine powdery mildew, the most important fungal disease impacting grapes.
Powdery mildew is probably number one disease issue here in the valley for all grape sectors. So talking about wine, raisin, and table grapes. And it's also the most sprayed disease here in the valley. So average, you know, talking about, at least 6 to 8 sprays per year. So it's quite intense spray program. For table grapes, even higher. So, you know, it's the most sprayed disease here in the valley.
Creating a sound fungicide program is critical to the prevention of this disease and any potential outbreaks in the future. And attending consultants aren't going to want to miss this valuable information to protect one of the state's most lucrative crops.
The basic of the, you know, the disease management is always the same, right? You know, talking about the disease triangles, you need to have a host, you know, disease, then environment. So basically it's going to be some refresh of the fundamental knowledge of the powdery mildew management. But the key point, I think probably there are two key points for the update is one of the, you know, the fungicide resistant management, you know, has been a lot of discussion in the past, and there are, you know, some new research going on to really get into the details how to manage the fungicide resistance. We're going to touch a little bit more about that, you know, in terms of resistance of the powdery mildew fungicide. Then the second update is going to be, you know, how those changing, you know, climate going to impact the disease pressure, right? So this year, if growers of PCA are from the valley, they might already experience, you know, the 4 weeks, about every day is 100 plus, right? We're talking about a lot about the water stress, a lot of the, you know, the heat damage from the heat wave, from the super high temperature. But one of the overlooked issue from the, you know, changing climate, whatever you want to call extreme weather events, is how they're going to change on the, you know, disease expression, right? Talking about on this conference going to be, you know, how those changing climate going to impact for the powdery mildew disease pressure. So we have some, one of the beauty here in the valley, you know, particularly for grapes, is that in the Fresno Madera area, we have about many, weather stations here. Right now we have about 9 weather stations in Fresno Madera area. And one of those, most of the station has been established back in 2003 or 2002. So we're talking about, we have about 20 years data in terms of how those, disease pressure change from 2002 to, you know, until this year. So there's some interesting update from the data. So, and I think that'll be great to share with PCA and growers for them to understand how those changing climate gonna change the powdery mildew disease pressure here.
According to Zhuang, disease pressure for powdery mildew is heavier than it's been last year. All the more reason to come out and listen to this information at the Crop Consultant Conference in Visalia.
We have a couple of late rains this year, so that somehow promotes a little bit disease pressure on the vines. And also, I think from last year's drought, growers this year pay much more attention on the water management. So I assume most people put a little bit more water in the springtime to promote the canopy to grow. So that might add a little bit of disease pressure for the powdery mildew. So in general, I'll say overall the disease pressure probably a little bit heavier than last year.
You're listening to My Ag Life. I'm Taylor Chalstrom.
Do you know the nutrient use efficiency people? Yes, I'm talking about the folks at Verdesian Life Sciences that deliver crop insights and solutions so California crops grow to their full potential. From micros with a proprietary delivery system to solutions that help improve the uptake and assimilation of applied nutrients. Visit VLSCI.com to learn more about Verdesian Solutions or to connect with a local representative right here in California.
In national agricultural news now, a new $550 million program from the Department of Agriculture seeks to support projects that help underserved producers. The program supports projects that enable producers access to land, capital, and markets, and trains the next diverse generation of agricultural professionals. The investments are made through the funding provided in the American Rescue Plan Act, as amended by the Inflation Reduction Act. The provisions fund and direct USDA to take action to help ensure underserved producers have the resources, tools, programs, and technical support they need to succeed. Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack says the funding is part of USDA's unwavering commitment to advancing equity for all, including people who have been underserved, marginalized, and adversely affected by persistent poverty and inequality. The program includes up to $300 million for increased land, capital, and market access projects aimed at helping underserved producers. An additional $250 million goes to the From Learning to Leading, Cultivating the Next Generation of Diverse Food and Agriculture Professionals Program. In addition to that, the Department of Agriculture has announced $121 million this week in funding for critical infrastructure to combat climate change in rural America. The investments include $111 million for 289 projects to help people living in socially vulnerable communities. USDA Deputy Secretary Dr. Jewel Brona says the investments will strengthen the energy security, create good-paying jobs, and save Americans money on their energy costs. The funding will help people in 49 states, Guam, and Puerto Rico. It reflects in many ways USDA rural development helps rural residents, businesses, and communities address economic development, infrastructure, and social service needs, according to USDA. Brona highlighted a total of 415 investments that USDA is making through these three programs designed to help people and businesses in rural areas. The programs are community facilities, disaster grants, Rural Energy for America Program, Renewable Energy Systems and Energy Efficiency Improvement Guarantee Loans and Grants, and Rural Energy for America Program, Energy Audits and Renewable Energy Development Grants. Households in rural, persistently poor communities were least likely to have home internet in 2015 to 2019, according to USDA's Economic Research Service. The data released this week shows more than 3 in 10 households lack internet access at home. In comparison, only 2 in 10 households in rural counties that were not persistently poor had no internet access at home. A similar pattern was observed in urban areas, with 2 in 10 households in persistently poor counties lacking home internet access. Only a little more than 1 in 10 households in urban counties that were not persistently poor had no internet access at home. For households with internet access at home, service was mainly through a subscription, which includes a range of access from dial-up to broadband to cellular data plans. USDA says the gaps in at-home internet access and subscriptions suggest that households in persistently poor communities, and more specifically households in rural persistently poor counties, had additional barriers to internet adoption. The ethanol industry says the Biden administration needs to ramp up the importance it places on flex fuel versus electric vehicles. E15 and E85 cars and trucks that help boost the demand for homegrown crops are just as important as electric vehicles, now supercharged by the just enacted Inflation Reduction Act. Renewable Fuels Association head Jeff Cooper.
We think it's going to take both flex fuel vehicles and electric vehicles to significantly reduce our petroleum consumption in this country and to, you know, help insulate the U.S. economy from the volatility that we see in the crude oil market. We do wish there was a little more emphasis, or at least the same amount of emphasis put on FFVs that we see on electric vehicles currently.
The U.S. flex fuel vehicles fleet is the second largest in the world after Brazil, with more than 21 million U.S. E85 FFVs registered by 2018, but with E85 use limited by a lack of refueling infrastructure and failure by some automakers to label the vehicles. The recently passed Inflation Reduction Act will funnel a decent chunk of money to agriculture to battle greenhouse gas emissions from livestock and soil tillage. But the Washington Policy Center's Initiative on Ag Director Pam Lewison says ag already does a lot of things that they're calling for.
And I think a lot of the reason people don't talk about it is because it's handy to say, well, ag, they're not doing anything. Because a lot of what ag is doing is complicated, and it's very scientific, and it's difficult to distill it down into something that's easily palatable and easily understandable for people who are unfamiliar with it.
In the meantime, farmers typically have better things to do, she says.
I think that is part of it, too, is farmers in general are sort of that frame of mind, what do you want from me? There's this sort of pervasive notion of, I'm doing what you asked, why do I have to explain it? And I think that's problematic. I would love to see the ag community run, not walk, to the table and say, on a proactive level, these are the things that we do already.
Lewison says agriculture contributes just 11% of the total GHG emissions in the U.S., the smallest of any sector tracked by the Environmental Protection Agency.
So I think that we have to be careful about how we craft that conversation. And that certainly means that there needs to be open-minded discussion from everyone at the table.
She says just by the nature of farming practices, farmers are involved in the discussions.
Generally speaking, I can't think of people who are more conscious about how they treat their soil than farmers, because it behooves them to look at, you know, what is the most beneficial thing for my land. And if no-till is the most beneficial thing, there's 100% a reason for that.
Lewison says a better answer for climate change and ag would be fewer taxes and more options for the way ag does things. She says urban politicians are creating rules that is making farming harder or that ignore key needs for the industry.
There's giant potential sleeping in your soil. Under drought conditions, it's never been more important to wake it up. Phycoterra, a superior soil microbial food, activates the native microbes responsible for your soil's health and water-holding capacity. Adding Phycoterra to your crop increases water retention up to 10% and optimizes crop nutrient availability. Plus, it delivers excellent mixability and application flexibility, making it easy to add to your existing crop input strategy. Visit Phycoterra.com to learn how you can wake up your soil's giant potential with Phycoterra.
When Kevin Brixey and his wife Betsy moved to Ramona in the early 2000s, they were trying to figure out what to produce. Initially, they grew Australian plants while Kevin worked full-time off the farm. When they became serious about farming, the Brixies said they looked at grapes but wanted a crop not everybody else was growing. They also looked at blueberries, but they settled on dragon fruit and grew their operation into Dragon Delights, located in northern San Diego County. It will be one of two dragon fruit farms featured on the September 8th Dragon Fruit Production Tour and Workshop presented by UC Cooperative Extension.
We had a small piece of property, and we had been just growing Australian plants, and I had been working a regular job when we decided that we needed to look at something different that might grow in this area and didn't use as much water and had the potential to make a reasonable income. So we started looking, and there was quite a few options at the time. We were looking at grapes and hops and blueberries, pomegranates, they were the things that people were talking about. But my wife here actually saw something at a display in the county fair, and she brought me over to it. And here she goes. She's going to tell me the rest.
I was talking with one of the gentlemen from the Farm Bureau, and I asked him about potential things to grow in our area. We knew a lot of people were going into grapes, but we didn't really want to do that because we didn't want to do the same thing as everybody else was doing. So he mentioned the low-chill blueberries and the dragon fruit, which we had no knowledge of. So after we spoke with him, we went and hunted down a dragon fruit and we tried it, and it was a white, and we weren't super impressed with it. But the gentleman had also invited us to a Pattaya festival that was happening a couple months later. So we went to that, and it was there that we were introduced to all the different varieties of dragon fruit. And we did some more research after that and realized it would be a good fit for us.
The Brixies open their farm to the public on weekends during the season, and Kevin said that has been an eye-opening experience about public perception of dragon fruit, also called Pattaya. Consumers are allowed to sample the different varieties and provide feedback about what ones they like.
We decided to let people come onto the farm and try the different types of dragon fruit. And that was the an eye-opener for us, because we learned a lot about what public perception was for it, how many people had never seen it or tasted it, and also those that hadn't tasted the locally grown fruit, which was quite a lot better than a lot of the pieces they'd tried in the store. So it's been interesting learning what people like, but also we've been able to have the opportunity to let people learn about dragon fruit. Many people have never tried it or didn't know anything about it. So we're sort of, helping to promote the dragon fruit by letting people come and taste it.
Betsy said many visitors are familiar with dragon fruit because of its popularity in beverages, such as those made by Starbucks or different breweries. But she said many don't know what real dragon fruit tastes like until they sample some of their locally grown fruit. Having them visit Dragon Delights also gives the Brixies an opportunity to educate them about dragon fruit and their strong nutritional profile.
And a lot of the dragon fruit labels that have been put on everything, people can't really identify what is exactly the dragon fruit flavor. I know, like with the Starbucks drink, a lot of people really like that drink, but it doesn't really taste like dragon fruit. They have little bits of dragon fruit in there, but they're always sort of amazed when they try the fruit that it's different than that sweet kind of refreshing drink. So it's been, like Kevin said, an opportunity for us to educate people on what the fruit is and a little bit more about it just being a novel new fruit, but also the health benefits of it too. It's a very nutrient-rich fruit.
The most common dragon fruit type has a bright pink outside with white flesh inside. The black seeds, which resemble poppy seeds, are sprinkled around the white flesh. But Kevin said as the public has become more educated about dragon fruit, they've migrated toward the pink and red flesh varieties that have more intense flavor. Among the varieties grown by Dragon Delights are Delight, which is a white flesh variety, as well as Maria Rosa, Sugar Dragon, Physical Graffiti, Vietnamese Giant, and American Beauty.
Probably the most popular dragon fruit variety, when we first started looking back in 2014, most of the stores were carrying that white with the bright pink outside. It was very good. But as people have found these new varieties that we grow, mostly the pinks and the reds, we found that the flavor and the sweetness is better. And people are choosing to follow the sweetness and the flavor. So we're seeing that the whites are not as popular as the reds now. And many of the varieties we grow and most other growers are all looking at the deep reds, the fuchsia purple styles of dragon fruit, which is very popular with the public.
Dragon fruit are produced by cactus native to parts of Central and South America. As cactus, they require minimal irrigation. They also do well in warm, sunny climates and are susceptible to frosts. Although dragon fruit prefers sunny locations, Kevin said they use shade cloth over some of their plants to soften the summer sun.
You can grow the dragon fruit in this climate, and it does quite well. It's mild enough and dry enough that we can do it organically. It's probably a little hotter than probably where it grows native to South America. So we chose ourselves to grow some of ours using some shade to help soften the heat, the summer heat. But it does grow in the open quite well, and we do have a nice, warm, temperate summer, and that's what makes the dragon fruit grow so well. The heat and the sunlight help to promote the budding and the flowering, and all the while there's heat and sunshine, they continue to flower in multiple, they'll have bloom after bloom during the summer period. So, for example, our one variety, Physical Graffiti, is looking for its fifth bloom this summer. And sometimes we get maybe six out of that. We get blooms as early as May and June, and then we start to see the fruit setting usually sometime in July. And we usually start selling by mid-July, And then we, with all the different blooms, we can still be selling our fruit right into early December sometimes, but usually by November, we've pretty much finished. It really, the plant follows the heat and the sunshine, and once it starts to cool down, it decides to stop flowering. And then we just it just becomes a green dormant plant during the winter.
The Brixies also sell potted dragon fruit plants and cuttings, which they say complements the entire tasting experience. They also sell dehydrated fruit that people can take home for later use.
I think the beauty is that when people can come in and try a piece of fresh fruit and they find something they really like, they can also identify the plant and they would like to purchase that plant because it's something they really like. It's not usually the same in most places where you go to a store and have a plant there, but you don't actually get to try the fruit. So it really enhances the whole sale because so many people want to go home and grow this plant and they know exactly what they're going to eat. And then by giving them dehydrated fruit and different ideas of what they can do with the fruit afterwards, so many people will take it and take the pulp and freeze it, and then they can use it as something they can use in smoothies during the off season. There's many recipes people can do with the fruit. They can make sorbets and ice creams and mixes for drinks. And so bringing people on and getting them to taste it and get them excited about it helps them to want to continue to buy it and use it.
Kevin and Betsy's operation will be one of two stops on the UC Cooperative Extension's Dragon Fruit Farm Production Tour and Workshop September 8th. Kevin said it's important to share ideas with other producers as learning experiences. When the entire industry comes together, as in these workshops or festivals, he said they can strengthen the California dragon fruit industry.
I believe that as an industry, we can learn a lot from each other. Everybody is doing something a little bit different. No one's got a right or a wrong way of doing this. We trellis, we use different varieties, we live in different locations, but by pooling our resources together and talking about the different issues that we have, I think the industry is going to be better for it and stronger. And I think as we work together, I think we can promote the California dragon fruit industry, I think, a lot better by working through these festivals and these tours that we do.
The deadline to register for the UC Farm Production Tour and Workshop is September 2nd. For more information, visit the San Diego County Cooperative Extension's website at https://cesandiego.ucanr.edu, then click on Petaheia/Dragon Fruit Production Tour and Workshop under upcoming events on the left-hand side. This is Vicki Boyd reporting for My Ag Life.
JCS Marketing is your number one way to connect with the ag industry. Through print magazines, digital media, podcasts, and live and virtual events, JCS Marketing has the reach to inform, educate, and influence growers in the Western United States.
Everywhere you go, you see West Coast Nut Magazine on every one of my customers' tables. So that tells you everything. It's there, so they're reading it.
Our My Ag Life platform includes podcast interviews and digital articles for busy professionals on the go. Our live events, continuing education webinars, and virtual conferences help growers connect with leading researchers and industry leaders. Let JCS Marketing help you connect.
That will wrap up today's show. You've been listening to the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm Lori Boyer. From all of us here at the JCS Marketing team, thank you for listening.